So good morning. My name is Mike Niehaus, and for the next hour, we want to talk about Windows as a Service. As I was talking with Malad yesterday, there were some things that we wanted to add into the conversation with some recent changes, so we've added content into the deck that I'm using to present. I'm not 100% sure I can do it in an hour, but I'm going to do my best to get through all of this. So let's get started. First, we want to talk about why we want to do Windows as a Service. So it's good to understand what kind of the forcing factor is behind this. As a whole, Microsoft wants to move to a more agile way of developing software. That goes across all of our different products, Windows, Office, Azure, System Center. All of them are moving to a more frequent release cadence so that we can get new value out to customers faster, so that we can address security challenges faster, and really so that we can simplify the deployment and management of these capabilities over time. Instead of doing big projects every so often, every several years, we want to do small projects much more frequently. So that's the goal, to simplify and be more agile. From a security perspective, we're really looking to address the challenges that we've seen over the past few years. If we look at a release schedule where we're doing releases every 3 to 5 years, we see large gaps where the platform stays steady for that entire period of time. That gives the bad guys a stable platform to try to find vulnerabilities in. If we move to a release schedule where we're releasing every 6 months, which is about the schedule that we want to get to with Windows as a Service, the bad guys have a much smaller window of time to exploit any operating system shortcomings. So by continually updating that, we hope that we can always stay ahead of the bad guys. From a project perspective, reducing the size of the project is going to be key. I mean, we can't ask you to deploy every 6 months, which is about 10 times as fast as what most organizations would compare it against historically. We can't ask you to go 10 times as fast without making it about 1/10 of the cost. So how do we make that deployment project shrink to something that's much more reasonable? We had to do that by attacking the biggest component of that cost, the deployment, by moving away from wipe and load and imaging to more of an in-place upgrade process, trying to eliminate the infrastructure dependencies or at least simplify them where we can, and also to reduce the application compatibility testing requirements. We want to just be able to deploy and make sure things work. So we think that we can do that, and once we do that, we get that to a much smaller project. That's not to say that you will do this without a project at all. You'll still want to do some amount of testing, some amount of validation, but we want to focus more on pilot deployments rather than big preparatory projects before you deploy the first PC. We've had a lot of success so far with Windows 10. We have over 400 million seats deployed globally. In businesses, we think that's about 50 million. It increases every day. We've been working with customers through the last year on their initial Windows 10 deployments, and we're starting to get data back from them where they've gone through this cycle more than once. And the results are pretty good. I mean, they're not perfect. We have a customer in the U.S., Kimberly Clark, big paper producer, who said that it's reduced their costs by 75%. That's good. It's not yet great, because if you think about it, we're deploying 10 times as fast. In order to get the cost down, it needs to be about 90%. So we know that we still have work to do, and we continue to work on enhancing and refining Windows as a Service with a bunch of changes that we introduce with each new release. It's all about driving that down to the kind of the bare minimum. So Windows as a Service overall changes how we build Windows, how we develop it, how we make it available to you. It changes how we deploy Windows, and it changes how we service Windows. To dig into each one of those, let's first talk about building Windows. When we build Windows now, it's all out in the open. We have the Windows Insider program where we release builds to the public generally about once a week for the fast ring, once a month if you don't want them quite so quickly. Inside of Microsoft, we do a build a day. The engineering teams, myself included, will install a new build of Windows every single day. So we get used to the routine of trying out the latest code as soon as it's written, so that we can find issues, resolve those issues, make sure that the product quality is always ready to ship. We'll expand that group to a broad test of Microsoft testers, Microsoft employees who have volunteered to try out these new builds, so that we get tens of thousands of people trying out builds roughly about once a week prior to making them available publicly. After they sign off, then we can make them available externally to the insider preview population. So you see the new capabilities, you see the changes in Windows, and you can validate the overall application compatibility, infrastructure compatibility, and just give us feedback on everything you see in what's going to be the next release of Windows. So we start off there with the Insider Preview branch. We hope every organization has some number of PCs enrolled in the Insider Preview. It doesn't have to be your primary work PC. It could be a device you're using just for testing. But we want you to be able to see the new capabilities and provide us feedback. Once we release, after going through those cycles for about 6 months, we'll release this and declare it as a current branch release. That current branch release, we hope that organizations will start deploying it right away. Don't wait, deploy, start the piloting process so that we can get feedback and address issues during these first few months of each release's lifespan. We think that every organization should be able to deploy to 10 to 20% of their PCs to be able to get broad coverage of about 90% of the apps that are used in the organization. So you have to select the pilot participants fairly carefully and use the feedback that you get from those pilot participants to make sure that everything's going well. All of that piloting work is to prepare for broad deployment. We want to broadly deploy each of these new Windows 10 releases about 4 months after they've been released. We declare that a particular release is ready for broad deployment by saying it's now a current branch for business release. That's not a new set of bits. That's just a declaration to say that we believe this particular Windows 10 release, like Windows 10 1607, plus the most recent cumulative update, for example, the November Patch Tuesday update that we released, is of sufficient quality to then broadly deploy through the organization. We do have a long-term servicing branch available, but we really want to focus that just on special purpose systems. Those special purpose systems would be things like ATM machines, PCs controlling factory floor equipment, PCs that are used to control nuclear reactors, things that are truly critical that are being used and shouldn't get any new functionality for the life of that device. They're just used for that one task. Generally, a PC that's running Office isn't a special purpose PC. It's a general PC being used for information worker activities. So those types of PCs should run current branch or current branch for business. LTSB, because it gets you back into that big deployment project mold, is still too expensive for the general population. It works well for those special purpose PC requirements. When we look at the whole cycle, we go through the insider preview process, going through that iterative process for about 6 months. Then we do a release. That release is then deployed within an organization as a series of pilot groups. We would call those rings. Once we've declared current branch for business, now we do the broad deployment. During the pilot, we're looking to cover as many applications as possible to make sure everything's working okay. During broad deployment, we shift to focusing on risk reduction. We want to make sure that if we deploy to a particular group, we don't disable any particular part of the company. For example, you wouldn't want to deploy the entire accounting organization at once. You probably want to do a third of the accounting group in one ring a third in a second ring, a third in a third ring, just to reduce the risk overall if something unexpected happens. From a patching perspective, we've also changed the way we service Windows. After we've released a particular version, we wanted to solve some of the problems that we've had in the past. If we look at Windows 7 and Windows 8.1, most customers have selectively patched. They'll deploy every security update we ever release, with a few exceptions for ones that may have caused compatibility issues, but they'll selectively install all the non-security updates. So we end up with a kind of a mess where every PC out there is a little different from a patch perspective. When we build new patches for Windows, we test on a fully patched PC. So our testing environment doesn't match the real world and really never could because of the number of different variations that we see in the real world. So that's what we wanted to eliminate. With Windows 10, we moved to a cumulative update model where all security and non-security updates are included within that cumulative update. So we will always have a fully patched PC to work from. What we've seen so far is that reduces the number of support calls by about 25% because all the fixes are being deployed and because our testing matches the real world, so we're able to better find issues before we release updates. When we talk about servicing, we have two different terms. It's important to understand the difference. Quality updates are what I was just talking about, those monthly patches that go to existing Windows releases. We then also have feature updates. Feature updates are the every 6 months or so new releases of Windows 10 that contain new functionality. When we look at the timelines, we go through the 6 month development. We have a 4 month piloting cycle during current branch. Once we've declared current branch for business, then we start the broad deployment, and we can continue to use that release until it's time to move to the next one. We've added a 60-day grace period to the end of the life cycle for each release. If we look at why, you have to start stacking these on top of each other. When we look at several of these stacked up, we start to see a pattern to these. We want to get to the point where we always have two CBB releases supported in the market at all times, so that when a third CBB release is declared, that signals the end of servicing for the N-2 version. So the 60-day grace period is to give you that extra time after we declare the CBB for the current release to make sure that any straggler PCs you have on that older version are moved forward. Just to illustrate that a little bit, if we kind of draw some lines on this, we just declared CBB for 1607, so we're at this point in time. If we follow the line up to the N-2 version, that's 1507, so that now means that we're into the grace period for 1607. It will get a couple of additional months of updates, and then servicing will stop. We hear a lot from customers who also say, well, maybe I want to skip a release. Like maybe I want to go directly from 1507 to 1607, which isn't something we recommend, primarily because of what that looks like on this particular diagram. If you wanted to do that, you would have to start from the 1607 release, so you could start at that point in time, but you need to finish by the end of the grace period. So that's about a 6 month window. You would have to deploy every single PC in the organization within 6 months, which is very risky in case you find any issues in that period of time that would cause you to pause your deployment. You may not be able to get all of the PCs off of 1507 before 1507 is no longer patched. So generally we recommend deploying each one of those, which means that you're typically going to be in three cycles at once. You're going to be evaluating the next insider preview while you're doing pilots of the previous release while you still may be doing broad deployments of the one before that. So you'll always be in that perpetual cycle of keeping Windows up to date. When we look at the how, we're back to that picture that we were looking at before of taking these big deployment projects that were done every 3 to 5 years and trying to shrink them into those small deployment projects that we want to do about twice per year. To do that, again, reduce the application testing cost by just doing pilots instead of structured testing. Simplify the infrastructure updating process, which is where Config Manager and their current branch comes in. They've gotten to the point where now to keep Config Manager up to date, you just go into the Config Manager console, find the latest Config Manager release, right-click on it, and say install. It's a trivial process to keep Config Manager up to date. And the deployment process itself, again, uses an in-place upgrade process so that you don't need to create images, you don't need to reinstall apps, you don't need to re-inject drivers, you just need to deploy the update. From a compatibility perspective, the only way that that model works is if we can maintain very high levels of compatibility. From a desktop app perspective, what we've heard from customers who've been trying this out is compatibility over 99%. Almost every application just works. It's not 100% because developers still find creative ways to break things, but it's pretty close to that. All we really need to do then is deploy, pilot, and have the users pick up the phone, call the help desk for any issues they encounter. We make sure that compatibility stays high primarily because we're not changing the Win32 APIs that these apps use. If we don't change the APIs, we don't break anything. We also watch telemetry during insider preview to look for application crashes. If we start to see trends, we know something's wrong. We can also watch usage information from applications. So if we ship out a particular build and we notice that maybe Internet Explorer usage goes down to zero, something's wrong. It should stay at a constant level. So we can investigate issues like that just by monitoring telemetry in the insider preview builds. From a website perspective, we have two browsers included in Windows 10. Edge for the modern websites, things that are very well behaved for HTML5 capabilities. And then we include IE11 for backwards compatibility. So for older websites that don't necessarily respect modern web standards, we'll continue to include IE11 as long as anyone cares. So that becomes the dual browser strategy. We want all modern stuff to run in Edge, all older stuff to run in IE, with policy-driven controls to direct what goes where. The user shouldn't have to worry about that. The user should just be able to type in a URL and go. With Windows 10 originally, we had set a policy so that if you went into Edge and typed in a URL that didn't work with Edge, it would redirect it to IE. With Windows 10 16.07, we added a new IE11 policy that says if someone then types a URL into IE11 that doesn't require IE11, it redirects it back to Edge. So we make sure the user stays in the right browser for the website that they're trying to use. That's all built on top of enterprise mode. Enterprise mode, a capability in IE11, allows you to define those rules to say these websites should run in IE, these websites should run in Edge. From a compatibility perspective, just proving that it works isn't always enough. You also want support statements from the ISVs, people who sell you the software. So we've been working with the ISVs to gather together those support statements and to make sure that all of those ISVs understand Windows as a service. The Ready for Windows website is kind of a one-stop shop for finding those support statements. You can go to readyforwindows.com, search for a particular vendor, maybe Citrix, be able to find the list of all their applications, and not only see a link to their support statements, but also get usage information for those apps. Like we would be able to see that Citrix Receiver is in use on Windows 10 devices for probably 15 different versions, for versions that are highly adopted, meaning that they're used on thousands of Windows 10 devices already. If no one's complaining about those, it's a good sign that the application works just fine. So if you're already running a version of a particular application that's highly adopted by other people in the world, it's not one you need to focus your testing on. You can instead focus your testing on applications that aren't highly adopted. Maybe you're running a version that's 3 years old, and we can't see any proof that that version is highly adopted by other customers on Windows 10. That might be a sign that you may want to put a little bit more testing into that application to make sure that it still works. But that's one tool that you can make use of. It's free. Go out, search through it, see the data that's available. We want to build up a process for these applications to bring some order to this. First, we need an application portfolio. If you don't have a list of applications that you support in your organization, all bets are off. If you don't know what you have, it's pretty hard to have any type of control over validating it. Once we have that portfolio, we can prioritize it and then focus in on the most business-critical apps. For the business-critical ones, the hope is that that's about 10 to 20% of the apps. The other 80 to 90% are probably just general productivity apps that are used by information workers to get their jobs done. Those aren't quite as important. The business won't fail without them. You'll just have some grumpy users if they try them and they don't work. So we want to focus on the business critical ones. We can do structured testing on those to pre-validate them before we deploy, and then leverage pilots to validate the rest. That's the goal. We want to do piloting to make sure that we can test the apps without calling it testing. It's deploying and then seeing what happens. It's very reactive. We want the users to pick up the phone if they run into any issues. We have another tool called Windows Upgrade Analytics, which can help with this. This is the first of a suite of applications that we want to deliver, which we've been calling Windows Analytics as kind of the umbrella term. Windows Upgrade Analytics provides the ability to see, here's the software in use in my environment, here are the drivers, here are the web pages that are being visited. So you get information about what's going on in your environment and then work through that information. So it enables you to see known issues with apps that you're running, have remediation steps for those apps, which might be install this patch in order to fix the issue, and really getting ready to then do a pilot to a group of PCs. So it can tell you which PCs are ready for a pilot because we don't see any known issues that those particular PCs would encounter. It's a free tool. It's built on top of Windows telemetry, so it does require having telemetry enabled to at least the basic level. We have fully documented what telemetry gets sent by that basic level, so you can read through and see all the information that gets sent to the cloud before it's gathered together and presented to you through Windows Upgrade Analytics. When we talk about feature updates, remember these are full Windows releases. As full Windows releases, it's effectively a new set of Windows media. So the general concern for most customers is size. How big are these? Well, most people look at this and say they're 3.5 gigabytes. 3.5 gigabytes is huge. We can't deploy 3.5 gigabytes to every PC. Well, if you're using media, yes, they're 3.5 gigabytes. If you use electronic software distribution files, ESD files, those are only 2.5 gigabytes. So they're a gigabyte smaller just because they're compressed differently. So if you use WSUS or Windows Update or Windows Update for Business or Config Manager and its Windows 10 servicing capabilities, all of those servicing-oriented approaches can leverage those ESD files to get you about a 30% reduction without doing anything. Switching to ESD files is a great thing. But we can do better. and we're working on doing better. We want to move to a new process later in 2017 where we start doing a differential upgrade. Each of these upgrades that we go through don't need to replace every single file in the operating system. As a result, we can figure out what files need to be downloaded from the server. We'll just download the files that have changed and then do the upgrade using that subset of content. Based on the analysis we've done, we think we can reduce the size about another 35%. A lot of the operating system files are changed from one release to the next, but 35% doesn't change, so we don't need to download that for each release. So we started at 3.5 gig. We went down to 2.5 gig by switching to ESD files. We go down to roughly around 1.8 gig by using this new differential upgrade capability. That won't happen with the creators update because we need to get a baseline build in place. The creators update is that baseline build, but then we'll use that differential upgrade with the next feature update later in 2017. The process itself, once the bits are downloaded, is exactly the same as what you see today. We'll download the content and then initiate the upgrade. Now, this will require some changes to the management tools and the patching tools that are used to deploy these feature updates. Those tool vendors will be working on adding support for this over the next several months as they get into 2017, really to prepare for this feature update that is released later in 2017. When we look at monthly patches, we have challenges there as well. Because these are cumulative, every month they get bigger. Well, most months they get bigger. Somehow we had a month where they got smaller, and no one can tell us exactly why that happened, but we're still investigating that one. But normally, they will always get bigger, because we're always adding new fixes to them. That means after about a year, we're looking at a size of somewhere around a gigabyte. These numbers are actually from Windows 10, 15, 11. So we followed it across a year, and we were right at a gigabyte after a year. That's huge to download to every PC per month. Fortunately, we don't need to download the full content to every PC per month. We just need to download the delta, the new fixes. That's where Express updates come in. We have this technology that's been around for many years where the Windows Update agent can figure out what changes are actually needed out of an Express update package that's contained on the server and just download the byte ranges that contain those changes. So the result is that instead of downloading a gigabyte per month, it just needs to download the delta, which is about 100 megabytes per month. Much more manageable. It's what you would see today with Windows 7 or Windows 8.1. To do that today with Windows Update for Business, WSUS, it's easy. All you need to do is enable Express updates in WSUS. It's automatic with Windows Update and Windows Update for Business. The challenge that we've had is that wasn't available to System Center Configuration Manager or third-party patching products because Windows didn't expose the APIs to enable those tools to use Express updates. I mean, they could download the Express updates through WSUS or from the Windows Update catalog, but once they were downloaded, they couldn't do anything with them. So first, we have to add support into Windows. We'll do that with the cumulative update that we expect to release for Windows 10 1607. That should come out early in Q1 2017. We're still working on the exact date. Hopefully it'll be in January, maybe February, somewhere in that time frame. But once you install that update, then the management tools can take advantage of that new capability to support doing Express updates. The Configuration Manager team has already been working on that. They've put the initial capabilities for that in the Config Manager 1610 release that came out recently. They'll also do probably a server hotfix to enable the server configuration controls around that. But once that's in place, then Config Manager will start using express updates for the monthly patches. So instead of a gigabyte, we're back to a reasonable 100 megabytes per month. So that's a good thing. For third parties, we're working on the documentation to publish to explain to everyone how to do this. So regardless of which patching tool you're using or management tool you're using to do patching, they'll all be able to do this express update support. So talk to your ISV if you aren't aware of their plans around that. Let them know that you're interested in that. We also encourage every customer to set up a peer-to-peer distribution mechanism. Because even with the improvements that we're talking about for feature updates to reduce the size by 35%, it's still moving something like 1.8 gigabytes per PC every 6 months. To make that more efficient, we can leverage branch cache, delivery optimization, or System Center Configuration Manager peer caching, or even third-party alternate content providers hooked into Config Manager to do much more intelligent distribution. We can get to the point where one PC downloads the content and then shares it to all the other PCs on that particular part of the network. So we don't overload the central data center switches. We don't overload the distribution points. We push the network traffic out to the edges of the network where that capacity exists. There's a lot more capacity on the edges of the network than there are in the center. So implement one of those tools. Depending on what type of management or patching tool you're using, you might implement a different one. Branch cache works well with Config Manager and WSUS. Delivery optimization works well with Windows Update, Windows Update for Business and WSUS. Config Manager implements their own. Most third-party products also implement their own. So depending on the tool you're using, the distribution mechanism might be different, but everyone should have a peer-to-peer mechanism in place. So when we talk about tools then, we've got a variety of them. We have Windows Update itself, which most enterprises, most organizations aren't going to point PCs to because they can't control when the updates are deployed. We have Windows Update for Business, which is really another layer on top of Windows Update that provides that level of control. Both of those are cloud services where you can get all the content from the internet. We also have Windows Server Update Services and System Center Configuration Manager. That's generally what most enterprises use today. In the case of Windows Server Update Services, WSUS, we require at least WSUS 4.0 in order to support feature updates. There are some hot fixes required for WSUS 4.0 to enable that. Once those are in place, then WSUS 4 can fully upgrade Windows 10 PCs to the latest feature update. Config Manager has a couple of choices in its deployments where you can use task sequences to upgrade PCs, or you can use Windows 10 servicing capabilities to upgrade PCs. A lot of people are using task sequences today. Remember the difference. Task sequences use media. Media is 3.5 gigabytes. Servicing uses ESD files. ESD files are only 2.5 gigabytes. The improvements that we're looking to make to do differential upgrades require using ESD files. So if you're going to continue using task sequences, that won't necessarily get you the benefits that you're looking for. Now, we are trying to convince the Config Manager team to add support for ESD files into task sequences, which would make things a little bit more flexible. So if you haven't seen the Config Manager user voice site, there are some suggestions to do that. Please go out and vote for those requests to add that type of support into Config Manager. So, from a high-level perspective, we want to make sure that everyone understands what Windows as a Service is. And we've been working on that by producing a lot of additional documentation. aka.mswaas, Windows as a Service, is the link to the Windows as a Service docs. If we look at that, turn off the pin. Without turning on the laser pointer. Let's do it this way. Ignore my Delta page. If I go to aka.ms, WAAS, that takes us to the primary documentation for Windows as a Service. We just added a new page to that, which has this quick guide to Windows as a Service. As a lot of people were kind of confused and we're throwing around terms and different ideas and concepts and rules, and we wanted to make sure that we got all of that into one place. So we start off just by defining the terms that we're using. Everyone should understand what's a feature update, what's a quality update, what's insider preview, what are our servicing branches, what do we mean when we're talking about deployment rings. Then we should understand releases are initially considered current branch. They become current branch for business after a period of time. We also have long-term servicing branch capabilities. We added into the rules that will support releases for a minimum of 18 months. Because customers were concerned we might start releasing more frequently. If we did three times a year with a rule that says we'll support two at one time, it would cause the support cycle to be too short. So, okay, fine, we'll just guarantee a minimum of 18 months. A minimum of 18 months means, hey, we will support each release for the equivalent amount of time that you would have gotten if we would release twice per year. So if you do the math, 18 months works out to 4 months for current branch, followed by 12 months for current branch for business, plus the 2 month grace period at the end, 18 months total. We also then talk briefly about the deployment process, using pilots, doing broad deployments after CBB declaration, using peer-to-peer distribution tools. So it's kind of the condensed version of everything I talked about today, put into one place with links into the rest of the Windows as a Service documentation explaining how to do more. We can also look at readyforwindows.com, which is the website that I referenced earlier. That website will allow us to search for particular applications. So maybe I want to search for Citrix and be able to see all of the applications that are available. And for each of those applications, see a link to the support statements where I can learn more about their support policy. And then see details about every version that we can see in our telemetry. We can see that a lot of people are running version 14.5.0.10018. So odds are, if you're running that version, which is highly adopted, you don't need to do much testing. But if you're running one of these versions where there's insufficient data, well, maybe you want to consider upgrading to a version that is highly adopted. Now, of course, there are some flaws in that. We can see a couple of new versions because Citrix had just released some updates at the top of the list. We don't have a lot of data on those new versions yet, so we would still say that there's insufficient data available, but over time, we would see more and more telemetry showing the increased use of those new versions. We also have the Windows Upgrade Analytics service. It takes that same Ready for Windows information and ties it into the inventory that you collect from your PCs. That inventory is sent as telemetry into the cloud and then presented back through the Windows Upgrade Analytics service. That service allows you then to drill into that data and see all the details from your organization. The service itself is built on top of the Microsoft Operations Management Suite, more specifically Log Analytics, which is an Azure component that's designed to really provide business intelligence capabilities around large sets of data. In this case, I can drill into information from my particular organization and kind of be able to walk through the deployment process. I can see the PCs that are available in my organization. There's about 15,000 of them. A few of them have been upgraded. I can see 59,000 applications, which is rather large, but this is Microsoft. For those, I can see which ones are installed on just a few PCs, which ones are manually marked as important. I can drill in and see which PCs don't have any known issues, which could be a good collection to be used for piloting. I can see known issues where I may need to do some specific action. I may need to deploy a particular fix. But in a lot of cases, my PCs are ready to upgrade. So I can take that list of PCs and use them with my management tool to drive the pilot deployments and then the broad deployments after that. We've been working with the configuration manager team as well to build a connector to this data. So you can actually tie that information directly back into Config Manager and then use that to drive your actual deployments. We can work on drivers. We can work on the deployment. We can work on web page discovery. The web page piece is optional. You have to turn that on as part of the deployment scripts for enabling upgrade analytics, because there are generally privacy concerns around collecting every website that a user visits. You can also target that to just internal websites or just specific internet domains. But it would tell you these are the sites that are most oftenly visited and what IE document mode is used for those particular websites, which is useful information as you get into application testing for those particular websites. So it's an easy solution to set up. You need to enable telemetry at the basic level. There is a organization identifier that needs to be generated and applied to the PCs in order to tell us which organization these PCs belong to. We can't show you the PCs that belong to your organization without that, because the telemetry is anonymous. With anonymous telemetry, well, it's just a big pool of PCs. We can't tell which ones came from where. The organization identifier just lets them be grouped together. So the registry gets tagged on each PC with that identifier so that you can then say, for Windows Upgrade Analytics, show me all the PCs that have that particular identifier. So we think you can use those services and the information that we have put together in the documentation to drive your pilot programs and to implement a Windows 10 servicing process. That servicing process involves multiple pieces. You have to figure out how to do the monthly patches, which isn't a big deal. We just want to make sure that we can use Express Updates so that we can get the size of them down. And then the every 6 month or so feature updates. We want to make sure that you have thought about that. How are you going to validate those? How are you going to pilot those? How are you going to then broadly deploy them through your organization? So, with that, I think I probably went through this too quickly. So, any questions around Windows as a service? Since we have a few minutes left. Sure. Yeah, so let me rephrase the question briefly. If you deploy PCs using current branch, and then after a while we declare current branch for business, is there anything that needs to be done for those PCs that were deployed using current branch? That's one of the challenges that we have with the terminology, is because we call them different things, current branch and current branch for business, people think they're different things. But really, they're the same Windows 10 release at different points in time. It's still Windows 10 1607. It's still Windows build 14393. That continues for the entire life. So the only real difference between current branch and current branch for business is time and the installation of at least the November Patch Tuesday cumulative update. So as you go through your normal patching process, all of those current branch PCs are already at the CBB servicing level before you even find out that we have signed off on CBB. Because we announced the sign-off on November 29th, based on a patch that came out, whatever the Patch Tuesday date was, like November 9th or something like that, you had already deployed that to all of your PCs before you even knew that was CBB. So nothing extra needs to be done for those PCs. They're already current. There's a question in the back. So the question was, will we have a Windows 11 or will we keep going with Windows 10? I mean, our intention is to just keep revising Windows 10 with new releases. So the focus stays on Windows 10 and keeping everyone current on Windows 10. That said, there are a lot of marketing people in this organization. There's no guarantee that it stays at Windows 10 forever, but at this point, Windows 10 it is. Now, because we had to talk about the new releases, like the Windows 10 Creators Update coming out early next year, we give them names just so that we can refer to the feature set that's going to be delivered in the next feature update. But after that ships, then we'll start talking about it using numbers again. Windows 10, 1507, 1511, 1607, 170 whatever. They're just more Windows 10 releases. So for things that are already out there, we'll just call those Windows 10 features. For things that are coming, well, we have to refer to them as something, which is where the names come in. But no plans on Windows 11 at this point.
Is there a Windows 7 upgrade analytics client? So for the customers that are planning their migration projects from Windows 7 now to Windows 10, that they can use this service? Or is it just a Windows 10 interface thing?
Yeah, the Windows upgrade analytics service. So the question was, is there an agent for Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 for Windows upgrade analytics? Today, the service focuses primarily on Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 to Windows 10 upgrades. We're working on adding the capability to let you specify a target so that you could say, for all these PCs running anything older than Windows 1607, our target is Windows 10 1607. Today, it's not configurable to be able to specify what target. But anyway, for Windows 7 and Windows 8.1, there are telemetry hotfixes that need to be deployed to the PCs. They're the same telemetry hotfixes that were used as part of the Get Windows 10 GWX process that you probably read about in the news at various points in time. Those hotfixes enable the telemetry to be sent. With that additional organizational ID, we can then gather the details from those PCs and show it through upgrade analytics. That's built into Windows 10. The telemetry agent is built in. With 7 and 8.1, there are some hot fixes that need to be installed.
Do you constantly update the ISO images that are available for download? If you have got a PC which is not on the internet?
Yeah, so the question was, do we constantly upgrade the ISO images? And no, we don't. Primarily because the process of doing that is overly bureaucratic and kind of slow. So it takes a long time to actually do that. An example is we just declared current branch for business for Windows 10 1607 on November 29th. We knew about it for a couple of weeks before then. So they started working on creating the new media and getting ready to distribute that. They didn't think they could get that done by the holidays, so they scheduled that to happen in January. So it's going to take that amount of time to get all of the ISOs updated, with the only real difference being that we took the original Windows 10 1607, injected the November Patch Tuesday update into it. Here's the new ISO. So because it takes so much time, because we had to assign part numbers and we have to do validation and checksums and signatures and sign-offs and all kinds of processes that go along with that, we want to minimize the amount of times that we do that. So generally, we expect to only do that once after each release. So we'll do it initially for the release when it's first current branch. We'll do it once more for current branch or business, and then probably never again. The only exception would be if we found a serious issue where it was much easier to fix the issue by using new media, then we would consider refreshing it again. We did that once with Windows 10 1507. We refreshed the media twice instead of once during its life cycle, but generally we want to minimize that just because of the amount of work.
So it's safe to take a 16 or 7 CV ISO image and then apply it with a number update, the same as using the CVV ISO image?
It is, yeah. So the question was, can I take the original 1507 ISO, mount the install.wim and inject the November cumulative update into it? That's exactly what we do as part of the media refresh process. So yes, that's safe, that's supported. The only restriction with that is that only works with media. So we're back to the discussion that we had before. Media, 3.5 gig, ESD files, 2.5 gig. You can't inject the update into the ESD files because you can't mount the ESD files. The ESD files are compressed in a way that can't be mounted. So you have to wait for the ESD files to be refreshed, which will happen in January for 1607 once.
Do you have any plans to give the user more influence on the exact time frame when upgrade is installed? For example, if you're using the CV branch, Microsoft decided today is a good time frame, I will upgrade it. The same situation will when the time frame is when you declare CVV. I think the CV, when a client is updated, relies only by Microsoft.
Yeah, so the question was, would there be any way for you to control when a particular feature update is installed? Generally, yes, but it depends on the SKU of Windows that you're running. If you're running Windows 10 Home, no. It upgrades whenever we determine it's an appropriate time to upgrade it. We give you an active hours window to control when the reboot happens, and it initiates that. But the upgrade itself, generally we throttle those as we do the initial release, and over a period of months we slowly upgrade all 350 million PCs. But for those running Windows 10 Pro or Windows 10 Enterprise, you get a lot more control. With Windows 10 Pro and Enterprise, when we talk about Windows Update for Business, what Windows Update for Business really is a set of policies that you can define on the PC that says how many days you want to defer. So you could say, I want this particular PC to delay until 60 days after CVV has been declared. Now, that is not something that the end user can do. There's no UI for configuring that. You can only set a policy to do that. Now, it could be a local GPO if you wanted to go in and do it that way, but typically for organizations, you would do that via a group policy pushed down to the device. If you have devices that are managed by WSUS or Config Manager, then you have complete control over when that happens because the feature updates won't deploy until you approve them for deployment. So kind of depends, but you don't have control if you just point the PCs to Windows Update. Over here.
So much times we have the same code base for the client and the server and stuff. Now it seems to be split client and server. So do we expect that the server goes the same way in the next time? Or do we have the old way in the infrastructure Windows 2016 and then the R2 and then so on? Or do we go in Windows as a service for the server as well?
Most of the development between Windows and Windows Server is shared. There are some additional server components that were done entirely by the server team building on top of what the client team builds as a base. There was recently a reorganization within the Windows teams to pull both of them into the same organization. So now it's just Windows. There's no Windows group and Windows Server group anymore. So really, they're on the same servicing strategy and mechanisms, but the difference is for client, the preferred mechanism is current branch and current branch for business. For server, the preferred mechanism is LTSB. So for the core and full UI installation options for Windows Server, LTSB is the only option. For the nano server installation choice, the only option is CBCBB. Will they eventually decide to have a CBCBB version of the full UI server? We've had those discussions, but so far nothing's been determined. The main reason that people have been asking for that isn't because they want new server functionality faster. It's because they want to use Windows Server as a remote desktop host. And if you use Windows Server as a remote desktop host, you don't have Edge. Because, hey, it's an LTSB release, and as a result, we remove Edge from LTSB. So the client user experience connecting into a Server 2016 remote desktop host is different than someone using a CBB Windows 10 host. So we've had lots of discussions around that. Nothing's been firmly decided, but they generally see servers as special purpose things that do a specific task, and that particular task isn't something well suited with new features being dropped on it every 6 months. Did Malad ask you to ask that question? So the question was, can you tell us a few things about the Shift F10 issue that's been in the press? Oh, I love our MVPs sometimes, but one of them posted a long blog that talked about how during the in-place upgrade process that's used for installing feature updates, it suspends BitLocker as part of that. So with BitLocker suspended, the drive contents are accessible during the upgrade process, which, okay, it's always been that way. In-place upgrades have always worked like that. So that was no big surprise. I mean, the big revelation in the blog was also something that's been there forever. You could hit Shift F10 in Windows PE and in later phases of the upgrade process, and it would open a command prompt running as local system, which would then also have access to everything that was on the hard drive. The thing about that is it makes it easier. It makes it so that a non-sophisticated user could do something like insert themselves into the administrators group as part of the upgrade process. So we definitely want to make that much harder. What we're working on for the creators update is to disable Shift F10 by default. That's what we're planning to do for that. That's not necessarily enough to stop a determined hacker, though, because a determined hacker really just needs to sit and wait until they see the PC reboot, insert a USB key, hit whatever BIOS key is necessary to boot to that temporary boot device, and they still have access to the temporarily decrypted, not decrypted, but clear text protector suspended BitLocker environment. So even though the data is still encrypted, anyone can get at it. That is a much harder problem to solve, but our security groups have looked at that and basically said that's back to the physical access challenge, that if you give someone physical access to the device for long enough, they'll probably figure out a way to break into it. In this case, they might have to sit and wait for 6 months waiting for that particular PC to upgrade itself and then hope that they manage to see it reboot so that they can insert a USB key and access the data that's on it. So it's a fairly small amount of risk. It is something that we're still looking at to see, is there more that we could do to make that harder? But overall, we don't see it as a high risk. It's just the Shift F10 does make it a bit too easy. So we will at least disable that for the creators update. Anything else? Sure.
Just last one thing. Can you clarify the statement about the sponsor ID that
Yeah, so the question was around the silicon support policy and Windows 7. What we had initially announced around Skylake was that Windows 7 would only support Skylake processors for a short period of time. Then we announced that we extended that amount of time. Then we announced we would support Windows 7 on Skylake through the end of Windows 7's life cycle. So as of now, Windows 7 on Skylake is supported through January 2020. Subsequent chipsets, like Kaby Lake, aren't supported at all with Windows 7. So in order to support Kaby Lake, you need to run Windows 10. For any new chipsets that get released, you need a new version of Windows, a new release of Windows to support those. In the case of Windows 10, if you're on current branch, no big deal, current branch for business, because we release every 6 months. Generally, we have access to the hardware before the rest of the world because we're validating it and doing the development necessary to support it. So by the time you can buy the hardware, there's already a Windows 10 version out there that supports it. The exception to that would be LTSB. Windows 10 LTSB releases aren't planned except for about every 3 years. We had an exception when we did the one in 2016 because we were aligning with Windows Server since it was an LTSB release. It made sense to do a client LTSB release at the same time. So we had LTSB releases a year apart, but we don't expect to see another LTSB release until 2019. That means that no new chipsets will be supported by Windows 10 Enterprise LTSB 2015 or 2016 until that new LTSB release comes out. So Cannon Lake and all the other chipsets coming after that, you won't be able to run with LTSB. You'll only be able to run with CB and CBB. Okay, well, you can continue buying Skylake and Kaby Lake PCs and run LTSB on that, but eventually they won't be sold anymore because the vendors will move on to Cannon Lake and subsequent chipsets. So there may come a time late in 2018 where you can't buy a PC that you can run a current LTSB release on. We recognize that's a bit of an issue. So we're still discussing that to figure out if there's anything we can do to kind of fill that gap between when you can't buy Skylake or Kaby Lake PCs anymore and you get LTSB 2019. We don't know how big that window is, but we recognize there's something we need to do for that window. So the question was around Windows Store for Business and whether it would become more manageable. What type of... Yeah, so what kind of manageability are you looking for? Oh, okay. Well, today we do allow you to build your own private store through the Windows Store for Business and set a policy to turn off the public store category. So effectively, you build a fully curated list of your own. We don't currently allow filtering by vendor or category or anything like that. They are things that we've considered and are looking at. They're just on the backlog at this point. The focus today is more around store convergence because we have too many stores. We have a Windows store, we have an Azure store, we have an Office store, we have 6 or 7 different stores. We want to have a single store, so that's the focus in the near term. That's not to say that we can't look at other manageability capabilities at the same time.
Would it be possible to get free apps out of the normal Windows Store without the Microsoft account?
The question was, can you get free apps out of the Windows Store without a Microsoft account? I actually saw a report today saying that that works in 1607. The only thing I'm not sure about is whether it's supposed to. So we're checking on that. But yes, we do think it's supposed to work that way. So I think we're okay on that one now. One more question, and then we should probably wrap it up because now we are over time.
Regarding the upgrade to management. I'm working in the public sector, and we have a
Yeah, so the question was, if you're using Windows Upgrade Analytics, which builds on top of Windows Telemetry, and you have PCs that can't connect to the internet, is there a way to make that work? Today, there isn't. The PCs would have to connect to the internet in order to deliver that telemetry data to us. It's something that we've been looking at, but no solution today. Basically, they would have to have internet connectivity. So with that, let's wrap it up. If there are any other questions, I'm not going anywhere, so track me down. Thanks for attending. Hopefully that was useful.